opposing the government to a confidence vote that are now far more restricted. Sunday, 19th of June's vote was also marred by record low turnout of French voters, a warning sign for Emmanuel Macron, who has promised to rule closer to the people for his second term in office, and a testament to voters' growing disaffection with French politics. There is a representation problem, said Aude Leroux, a 44-year-old who lives in Amiens, Emmanuel Macron's hometown in northern France, and shunned the ballot box on Sunday, 19th of June. Aude Leroux, who was heading over to clothing stalls in one of Amiens' large open-air markets, said she felt like the most important matter is already settled with the end of the presidential race. But Sunday's result may prove her wrong, as Emmanuel Macron could be forced into making compromises to pass bills and as opposition forces are expected to control key committees, such as the powerful Finance Committee that oversees the state budget. Incredible opportunities will come your way, Jean-Luc Mélenchon told his leftist lawmakers on Sunday. You have at your disposal a magnificent fighting tool.
Economic Divide.
When it comes to the new world order, that obviously will include a new financial order. But for that to happen, it's a tall order. But it is in motion. Two countries that are leading the way in establishing the mechanics of this, they are Russia and Iran. Hi, I'm Kavitavai, and this is Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the sanctioned ones. Iran and Russia are setting the new rules. They're doing that because they want to break the West's global financial grip. Will that happen, and how are they going about it? Also coming up in this program, we will take a look at the new settlement currency. It's pegged to the national currencies, and as a result, that will lead to the dollar collapse and undermine U.S. military and political power. Then we will take a look at the new what's called RIC. That's right. RIC to stand for Russia, Iran, and China. They're integrating their financial systems. And one of the things that's important is Iran, which is important to China in doing that.
The war in Ukraine and the ensuing crisis that emerged between Russia and the West has shifted the geopolitics and strategic alliances in Europe, West Asia, and Eurasia. Following the crisis, Russia was hit with a series of unprecedented sanctions that were aimed at making the country's economy collapse. But Russia appears to have survived the crisis. Moscow has now decided to shift its strategic partnership toward the East and to develop closer ties with countries like Iran and China. Iran has welcomed the move since it has been under Western unilateral sanctions for years. But over the years, Iran has managed to thwart Western economic pressures and revive its economy. The two countries, with China on their side, are now determined to further boost their ties in an effort to create a partnership that are immune to Western interference. Even before the war began in Ukraine, Iran and Russia were mulling to significantly boost their trade ties. When President Raisi visited Russia in January of this year, the two sides discussed a draft agreement on strategic cooperation for the next 20 years. Things now appear to fast-track between Russia and Iran, since both Moscow and Tehran are under Western sanctions. Barter arrangements are gaining ground. Tehran is offering spare parts and gas turbines to Moscow's power plants in exchange for much-needed zinc, aluminum, lead, and steel for its metal and mining industries. and more barter on a wide range of commodities is ahead, as discussed during a recent visit to Tehran by the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak.
Social media posts on this topic were varied, even though some out there are aware that there is a major transformation that's taking place, which will push the U.S. and Western countries down the global order a notch or two. The majority remain in the dark, which is why we are here. This is our first post. Russia now faces a greater number of U.S. sanctions than every other nation combined. The world's most sanctioned countries include two of India's neighbors, Myanmar and Iran. Now missing from the list are two other neighbors, each with a record of renegade actions, Pakistan and China. Next up, sanctions are a new form of warfare, causing the same amount of mass suffering and death. This is according to Abby Martin from the Empire Files. She says the goal is to decimate entire economies for refusing to bow down to the will of the empire. Next up, while the U.S. is busily impoverishing the EU and imposing sanctions that hurt their economy, Russia and China are opening the first automobile bridge across the Amur River between the two countries to start cargo traffic that will help boost trade turnover to $200 billion. Here's a viewer comment that says Janet Yellen is saying the restrictions on Russia are hurting U.S. homes, yet sanctions are effective. How can any sane individual support such nonsense? And our final post, soon President Xi will meet with Saudi Arabia King Salman. Could this be a new Quincy Pact? Drop the petrodollar and start working on a new financial system. Saudi Arabia has been supporting Russia on Ukraine and has very close ties with China. And it's not even taking Biden's calls. All right, those were some of the online posts there. Let me introduce our first guest for this segment of the Q&A, Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh joins us. He's a political analyst from Tehran. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome to Economic Divide. The Russia-Iran front has been fast evolving, but it really took a step up in its speed. In January of this year, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi went to Moscow, and they both signed on to a strategic cooperation deal of 20 years in duration, building on their good cooperation. And this obviously includes the expansion of economic ties. When it comes to the way that this now works out in the Ukraine war, will things fast track now that Russia is, like Iran, heavily sanctioned?
Iran has a lot of experience in let's say, circumventing or nullifying the sanctions for the last four decades. And now that the Russians are facing sanctions and a lot of economic problems, after the incidents and developments in Ukraine. So there are a lot of things that Tehran can share with Moscow. The point is that the global area, the global era, is moving toward more cooperation in regional levels. So the old world order is actually disappearing right now, and the new world order is actually forcing countries to establish regional cooperation with each other.
All right. Denis Rogatsiak joins us now. Let's see what he thinks. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano, who joins us from Mexico. Denis, welcome to Economic Divide. The first Eurasia Economic Forum actually was just held, and it's regarded as a milestone because it is said that it actually set up the parameters of the geo-economic integration, as it has been called, of the Eurasia heartland. Now you have Sergei Glazyev, Russia's minister in charge of integration and macroeconomics at that union, that said that there's a drive to design an alternative monetary financial system. Tell us how that works out and how that would undermine the U.S. dollar and in turn the U.S. itself, military and politically.
I believe what we're witnessing right now is kind of the phasing out of the U.S. dollar as the financial hegemon across the world, and I believe this is a process that has been taking place for a good part of the last 20 years. Not just with the rise of China, you know, the return of Russia, the drive for greater sovereignty, economic sovereignty across Latin America, say the expansion of the cooperation between the African continent and China, but also, of course, the recent events in Ukraine are actually also pushing towards the rise of I'll say the rise of Russia and China and Iran as sort of as kind of the financial and economic alternative to the United States, as we've seen now with Russia, with its vast economic power, particularly in the energy sector, has been effectively been has effectively been able to set the rules for energy prices with regards to with regards to the use of their national currency for purchases. So basically, you know, forcing their their partners in Europe and across the world to adopt ruble as the main means of exchange.
It is time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, the Bilderberg Group. That's right, you haven't heard that name in a while. Well, it has reconvened in person after a two-year pandemic gap. It's a high-level council of war, the way it was described. It was headlined by Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. Also within this, I guess, secret or not-so-secret meeting, a new financial system was also revealed. Of course, that is something that the Bilderberg Group is very much known for, the secrecy and how it executes it for a world order that they deem to be a world order. Next up, U.S. inflation hit a 40-year high of 8.6% as food, gas, and shelter costs have risen in that country, and that is increasing. And the inflation rate, well, it has sent the stock markets into a tailspin. For example, the S&P 500 has fallen over 2%, and NASDAQ was down over 3.5% as of the recording of this program. Next up, the Americas Summit. The Summit of the Americas was meant to counter China's influence. Instead, it showed how weak the U.S. was. The event was soured by snubs, diplomatic tensions on the rise in that summit, because even before it started, Mexico boycotted it, and others sent low-level delegates. And this is called one of the biggest flops of the Biden presidency and of this particular summit, the Summit of the Americas, hosted by the U.S. Our final pick, stagflation. The World Bank says most countries are headed for a recession, warning of a possible return to what's called the 1970s stagflation, which happened back then. Several years of above-average inflation and below-average growth are now likely because of it. So that is another challenge for not only the world economy, but countries in particular like the U.S. Well, those were the stories that we picked for this section called the InfoNews section. We would love to hear from you.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to sanctions, Iran was one of the countries sanctioned most by the U.S. That's a well-known fact. Although Russia at this point has taken the lead, both can now actually move forward and take the lead together in the way to basically evade sanctions, which is in line with what is unfolding, and that's the new financial order. Now, Sergei Glazyev, you may not have heard of him. He's a leading Russian economist. And he has said that a complete overhaul of the Western-dominated global monetary and financial system is under works, and the world's rising powers are buying into it. Now, this is, of course, countries, when he refers to that, Russia and then Iran, especially when it comes to the whole notion of sanction evasion. Now, the new monetary system, we've talked about that in previous programs. It is still unfolding, and its consequences are pretty dramatic. The Eurasia Economic Union and the China Association together, cooperation between the two, will catapult changes to continue this new financial order. This will ultimately entail the collapse of the dollar system, and the final undermining, as a result of that, of the U.S. military and political power. But what was the start of all of this? That's probably a question that you may ask. Well, this was thrown into high gear when U.S., EU, and the U.K. froze the Russian dollars reserves, that is, in Western central banks, $630 billion is what we had in terms of the foreign exchange reserves that Russia had. And that was a big mistake. This undermined the status of the dollar as a result, not to mention the euro and the pound as global reserve currencies. This was the death wish for the dollar, as some have said, and the euro, as it undermined, as I just mentioned, the status of the dollar, the euro, and the pound. So that move by the U.S. and its allies, in Europe in particular, undermined the status of the dollar through the confiscation of Russia's currencies in central banks. Okay. Now, the use of national currencies and clearing mechanisms backed by bilateral currency swaps is the first phase of this new financial system. Okay. There's three phases. The next phase, the new pricing mechanisms that do not reference the dollar. This is the second phase of the new financial system that is occurring as we speak. And then finally, third phase, that is comprised of the creation of a new digital payment currency, weight of each currency, and to make that shorter, is proportional to the GDP of each country. That is important. So there you have the new financial system in just a short form in terms of the explanation. However, let me bring back our guest to break this down further for us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh is a political analyst from Tehran who rejoins us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome back. We're looking at the countries that have been sanctioned, like Iran and Russia, and some have analyzed their cooperation as to be one that is setting new rules in this new financial global order. At this point, that is kind of paving the way for China when it comes to the U.S. sanctions in terms of how it is going to wean off the U.S. dollar as one of the things that it's going to do. We're also looking at Latin American countries who are moving away from the U.S. dollar. Can you please then tell us how all of this undermines the U.S. financial system in particular and the Western global stranglehold?
You know, there is a great opportunity right now for the sanctioned countries to work with each other. We would call it the sanction club, we can say. The club of countries that are sanctioned, put under the sanction of the Americans. And this is actually the fault of the Americans, that they overused actually their system of weaponization of dollar by imposing sanctions on countries across the world, and Iran, and Venezuela, and Cuba, and Russia, and Syria, and Lebanon, and many countries. They are imposing actually sanctions on. And this has created a club of countries that can work with each other without fear of further sanctions. Because Iran is has been sanctioned to the most, and even Trump administration admitted that they don't have any further sanctions to impose on Iran, and there is no further fear of any more sanctions.
All right, let's bring in Dennis Rogatyuk. He rejoins us. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano. Dennis Rogatyuk, welcome back. When you take a look at countries like Russia and Iran, they're the ones that have been leading the pack, so to speak, of Western sanctions, in particular by the U.S. This is in line with the new financial order that we're looking at, and people have referred to it as the New World Order. Can you tell us how this is going to reshape the way that countries are going to deal with each other away from the U.S. dollar?
Most definitely. We have to remember that Cuba, one of the countries sanctioned by the United States and blockaded by the United States, is actually an observer state to the Eurasian Economic Forum and already has extensive trade deals and investment deals with both Russia and China, sort of their two traditional trading partners. So I believe that Cuba will certainly play a huge part in helping to construct this new financial world order in across Latin America. But we also can't forget, you know, the role of Venezuela. Venezuela has traditionally been a key pillar in the world production of gas and oil, even despite the mass U.S. sanctions that have been imposed on the country, it continues to have an important role in OPEC.
Russia-Iran economic cooperation is not limited to bilateral ties. Russia is a founding member of the Eurasian Economic Union, which includes post-Soviet states located in Eurasia. A free trade agreement between Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union came into force in October 2019. That means that Iran and other member states and trading partners, which include China, will have the opportunity to enjoy free business and trade without the interference of the U.S. and its Western allies.
با توجه به روابط سیاسی ما با کشور روسیه و سایر کشورهای عضو اتحادیه، طبیعتاً اهمیت این اتحادیه و توسعه روابط ما با اون خودش رو بیشتر بروز و ظهور
می‌ده. The sticking point, though, is the integration of the financial systems of respective countries. Russia has created its own payment system for electronic fund transfers called MIR.
Мы подготовились и по финансовой системе. Мы создали свою систему аналог SWIFT. Это система передачи финансовых сообщений. У нас создана своя система платежных карт, Visa. Вместо Visa и MasterCard у нас работает карта MIR. Поэтому в этой части мы подготовили финансовую инфраструктуру, и она сейчас работает.
China's UnionPay system, which is becoming popular in Asian states, has become the largest card payment processing organization. But Chinese banks and its banking systems have been cautious in their ties with Russia over fears of sanctions. But Russia and Iran are turbocharging mutual settlements in their national currencies to the highest possible level. Iran is also set to accept Russia's MIR card payments, which means that the countries will be connecting their banks to the system for transfer of financial messages, or SPFS, the Russian equivalent to SWIFT. Moscow is eyeing crypto and digital currencies already, and Beijing is dead set on setting up the digital yuan to work around SWIFT, something that it has enacted already and has been used in many countries or provinces in China.
In this program, we have covered how Russia and Iran have paved the way for other countries, in particular on how to evade illegal sanctions that are applied by the U.S. to counter U.S.'s imperialistic and hegemonic aspirations. This is in line with the shift in the new financial world order. Now Iran has a new proposal, which would speed things up to that end. Iran has approached the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, with a proposal to create a new single currency. This would be used for carrying out trade among the members of the Eurasian bloc that includes China, India, and Russia, three of the largest emerging economies of the world. This would be another way to counter the increasing weaponization of the U.S. dollar, from sanctions to the dollar-denominated financial system. Tehran's proposal came during the time when the U.S. and its Western allies were announcing economic sanctions against Russia over its military conflict with Ukraine. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, earlier this month told the media that the proposal was sent to the SCO nearly 2 months ago. Iran hopes that the Eurasian bloc that it views as a concert of non-Western great powers will respond to the constantly changing geopolitical landscape and accept its proposal in due course. For Iran and Russia, this new currency will have immediate benefits. The two countries will be able to circumvent illegal Western sanctions to trade more openly with their SCO partner countries. Let's not forget, the SCO accounts for 44% of the world population and about a quarter of the global GDP. But do the benefits or gains outweigh the risks for other SCO members that are not the target of U.S. sanctions? Why should they gamble on this new currency for anyways? According to an estimate, the SCO countries lose approximately 10 to 20 billion U.S. dollars annually only on transaction and conversion charges. Still confused about why Iran has proposed the adoption of a new currency? Well, this should clear up any ambiguities for you. While many of the SCO countries have already initiated trading in local currencies with each other and in the process minimizing the use of the U.S. dollar as the currency of exchange, these transactions are mostly bilateral in nature. There's a need for either a common currency or a common payment platform that could automatically be used by each of the SCO members while trading with each other. That does it for this section of the program. Thank you. There's a new world order, and by default, a new financial order is also taking shape. We've said that time and again. But that is driven by countries who are working against the U.S. and Western hold on the world financial system, who have exercised various methods to control these countries, either through sanctions or otherwise. And perhaps this momentum is too fast for the U.S. to catch up to, which is good in one way, but bad in another way, because a political and military power like the U.S. is not going to give up its super status that easily. And we may see some negative reactions coming from that. That does for this edition of the program. From Mikhail Vitakhvay, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Flush with cash, a PAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its preferred candidates with millions. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "As the midterms approach, a PAC throws its weight and money around Washington." Stay tuned for more. Last week, Representative Chantel Brown defeated Nina Turner in an Ohio Democratic primary race for the second time in 9 months. Turner had been endorsed by Progressive Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is a vocal critic of the fabricated regime of Israel. Her loss is largely seen as a win for the Israel lobby and specifically the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. In December, APAC launched two political action committees, PACs, as a way to be more effective in fulfilling their mission in the current political environment, according to a statement published by the group on social media. In less than 6 months since it was established, APAC's PAC has delivered $6 million to hundreds of candidates, becoming the biggest pro-Israel PAC in the United States of America. While its super PAC, the United Democracy Project, UDP, has raised nearly $16 million in contributions. Since APAC's PAC operates as a traditional PAC, it can only spend $5,000 per candidate, but its super PAC can spend unlimited amounts of money. APAC said in a statement about its fundraising, "Our goal is to make America's friendship with Israel so robust, so certain, so broadly based, and so dependable that even the deep divisions of American politics can never imperil that relationship and the ability of the Jewish state to defend itself." Unquote. Flush with cash, APAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections, as it goes after progressives and floods its prepared and preferred candidates with millions. AIPAC congratulated Representative Brown on her election victory, writing that it's proud to stand with pro-Israel progressive leaders running against anti-Israel candidates. Endorsed by AIPAC, Brown received significant financial backing from the organization. According to campaign tracker Open Secrets, Brown received $83,171 from AIPAC Super PAC, UDP, and nearly $270,000 from its regular PAC, according to the Federal Election Commission. UDP also spent nearly $200,000 against Brown's opponent, Turner. UDP spokesman Patrick Dorton told Jewish Insider about the PAC's election season plans. "We intend to be active in a significant number of races where there is a clear difference between a candidate who supports a strong U.S.-Israel relationship and a candidate that does not or who may seek to undermine that relationship," unquote. Turner was targeted by the lobby for supporting conditioning aid to the fabricated regime of Israel and standing in solidarity with Palestine on Twitter. AIPAC has also had its hand in several other key races across the United States of America. The group had been actively involved in the Texas race between Jessica Cineros and Representative Henry Culler, as well as Pennsylvania's fight between Representative Summer Lee and Steve Irvin. According to FEC filings, AIPAC has spent over $1 million against Representative Lee and a combined total of more than $600,000 from both its PAC and Super PAC for Irvin. AIPAC's regular PAC must disclose its donor list, but the Super PAC isn't required to reveal contributors' identities. Both PAC's donors are a mix of real estate and finance moguls, but there are some notable contributors. Israeli-American media tycoon Haim Saban contributed the largest amount to UDP, with a donation of $1 million, but he isn't the only company head funneling pro-Israeli campaign contributions. The CEOs of several firms have also donated to the PACs. Ballot Flats brand Ticks co-founder and CEO Kefir Gavirelli gave $5,000 to AIPAC's PAC. The founder, CEO, and president of Tasty Brands, David Horowitz, pumped $50,000 into UDP. Jimmy Haber, CEO of BLT Restaurant Group, donated $5,000 to the regular PAC. Fernando Estriu, CEO of Mar Vista Entertainment, which was required by Fox in December, contributed $3,500 to AIPAC's PAC. Grant F. Smith, the director of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, sees these donor disclosures as an opportunity for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to more strategically target the fabricated regime of Israel's lobby. AIPAC has really exposed itself in the United States and provided a fairly wide-open arena for people who don't like their programs to start talking about their donors in ways that have never been possible before, Smith said. Yet with these significant political contributions comes significant political sway. Mega donor Saban has had a strong foothold in politics for decades. In 2002, he gave $13 million to the Brookings Institution to establish the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, now the Center for Middle East Policy. The center's founding director, Martin Indyk, openly supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saban's money has also kept former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in line with regard to the Zionist regime. The donations by Israel partisans have managed to keep almost every elected representative in Israel's pocket with almost no exceptions. Alison Weir, American journalist and founder of Research Institute, If Americans Knew, told me in Press News. AIPAC's PACs aren't backed just by CEO investors, but also by the organization itself. AIPAC's own employees have channeled more than $80,000 into its regular PAC. Within that sum, AIPAC president Betsy Korn poured $10,000 into the regular PAC through her company, B-Vision Sports Media. AIPAC received widespread criticism for endorsing 109 of the 147 Republicans who voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results following the January 6 insurrection at Capitol Hill. For Hickson, this development is telling because it underscores the growing divide among American Jews. AIPAC is becoming increasingly viewed as the Republican wing of the lobby, he said. Since its creation, a core tenet of AIPAC has been its bipartisanship, but Hickson believes AIPAC is moving farther and farther away from its original doctrine, explaining AIPAC hasn't cut off funding to Democrats who will take a pro-Israel line, but the fact that they support the far right and have identified so closely with former President Donald Trump is a significant change because it encourages these splits in a liberal Jewish so-called community. Polling suggests American Jews are becoming more critical of the fabricated regime of Israel, with a quarter considering it an apartheid regime. Democratic voters are also taking a harsher position on this regime, with a majority supporting sanctions over Israel settlement activity and more than 40% believing the U.S. should withhold aid to the Zionist regime. A University of Maryland poll also found that fewer than 1% of Democratic respondents view the Zionist regime as the U.S. first or second most important ally. According to Smith, AIPAC has always purported to be a unified voice of the American Jewish community, but that self-proclaimed title isn't true. During the joint IRMEP and American Educational Institute, Israel's influence, good or bad for America, 2016 conference, Smith debunked the lobby's false narrative that Americans who are Jewish are all Israel Affinity Organization members who support lobbying from these groups. According to a 2013 Pew Research Center survey on Jewish identity, 82% of American Jews aren't members of Israel lobbying organizations. Smith accordingly asked at the conference, "So who does the lobby really represent?" Well, the views and concerns of mega donors, for sure. The views and concerns of a relatively small group of boards and directors and top officials. And of course, the Israeli regime, with which many are in direct and ongoing consultation. With Jewish and Democratic voters becoming less concerned with the alliance between the United States of America and the Zionist regime, the gap between representative and constituents appears to be widening. As Weir put it, it's a contest between the elites that fund candidates and the grassroots that often want something different. So we are seeing that the elites, almost all of whom are pro-Israel, will continue giving huge amounts of money to candidates and buying a lot of candidates that way.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Today, arrogant France grandeur is broken and nations talk against the US. February 17, 2022. All the activists who had worked in these sectors have contributed to the continuation and perpetuation of the revolution. And of course, we have not done enough, and we have shown some negligence. Over the years, there may have been malicious intentions. There may have been some of these things, but great things have also been done. And if it had not been for these cases of negligence, the situation would have been better. I'd like to say that with the movement of the continuation of the revolution, today the revolution is thankfully both alive and productive and generative. When the arrogant front stands against the revolution and against the revolutionary nation of Iran and show great enmity, the reason is that the revolution is alive. If it had not been for the revolution, they would not have had any reason to be so vicious and evil against the Iranian nation.
اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What does survival of the revolution mean? It means the attachment of the new generations of the country to the ideals of the revolution. Today, people are attached to the same ideals that the revolution put forward. It means nations' independence, national dignity, national welfare, social justice, the realization of an Islamic society, and ultimately, as I said before, the creation of a new Islamic civilization. These are the great goals of the revolution. Our people today are attached to these goals. If they can do anything that is within their power, they will really do it. That is, the vast majority of the country has this attachment. Now, there may be people who are a little slow to move or do not move at all, but the Iranian nation is, generally speaking, attached to these ideals. The nation is attached, the revolution is alive, and the sign of the survival of the revolution is the enmity of the camp of arrogance, which stems from the insistence of the Islamic Republic on these goals. It is incorrect to say that the revolution has drifted away from its goals. One hears from some individuals that the revolution has strayed from its goals. This is not the case. If the country has strayed from the goals of the revolution, the enemies of the revolution would not have been so hostile to the system. The Islamic Republic and Islamic Iran.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done for me through all my years.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in my grandma's small yard. My grandma has gone on a trip to visit her relatives. Therefore, I'm here to water her plants. I love this small, beautiful yard. In this yard, there is a berry tree, a cherry tree, and a cypress, as well as red roses, petunias, and the shrub of night-blooming jasmine. These plants are abundant in Tehran and Alborz provinces, especially in the villages and suburbs around. Let's go to Shahristanak village today. This village is so beautiful and has really unique weather. I'll set off to this village after watering my grandma's plants. Shahristanak village is located in Asara rural district in Alborz province. This village is situated 55 kilometers northeast of Karaj, between Tehran and Alborz provinces. This village is 2,190 meters above the sea level. It's cold in winter and mild and pleasant in summer. A river which carries a huge volume of water passes through the village and pours into Karaj River. Shahristanak is a historical village. Nasiruddin Shah Qajar used to have a special palace in this village. The historical relics remained show that this village dates back to 6th century AH. Some of the historical relics in this village include Dozd Band Castle, Shensotun Hill, Nasiri Palace or Shahristanak Palace. And I am now in Shahristanak village. I'm standing by a very beautiful river, which its sound you can hear. Here is full of berry and cherry trees, which have no fruits at this time of the year. However, birds have perched on the branches of these trees and are singing charmingly. Oh, no music is attractive as what we hear in the nature. Don't you agree with me? and I am now in Shahristanak Palace. This palace was built in 1896 by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. Unfortunately, most parts of this beautiful palace have been damaged. Almost nothing has remained from the second floor of this building, though you can guess how beautiful this building used to be. Oh, look. This is a really big piece of rock. I think it's over 4 meters high. There are some carvings on this rock which cannot be read at all. By an old, huge cypress tree. Cypress is one of the ancient symbols of Iran. There are ancient cypress trees in almost every city in Iran. The height of this cypress tree is 17 meters, and it has a giant trunk. Oh, this tree is really pretty. I can't take my eyes off it. Oh, well, I'd like to sit beneath this old tree and lean against its trunk.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Demonstrators gathered from around France to demand the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner. George Ibrahim Abdullah, who was known as the Arab Nelson Mandela, has been imprisoned for more than 38 years and has become a beloved hero celebrated around the world.
In 1982, once again, Israel was invading Lebanon. Abdullah's resistance group claimed responsibility for the death of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris.
Abdullah has been eligible for parole since 1999. He refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and while some say that's a reason he hasn't been released, most believe it's due to political pressure from Washington and Tel Aviv.
We're here to demand freedom for both George Abdullah and for Palestine. Pro-Palestinian activists in France are fed up with the state's repression of our message, their support for Israel, and the lack of justice for our hero, Abdullah.
Abdullah is described as a model prisoner and maintains a vast correspondence with groups supporting anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics. Many believe Abdullah, a former schoolteacher and Maronite Christian, is exactly the type of unifying and heroic figure who could unite a fragmented and troubled Lebanese nation.
The reason of George Abdullah being arrested, not only because of his support to Palestine and his struggle, but because they are afraid of this icon, Arab and internationalist icon who influenced the left movement around the world.
No French media were at the demonstration for Abdullah. Despite the apparent Western media blackout, his supporters worldwide say they will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. This week, the British government approved the extradition to the United States of another famous political prisoner of the West, Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, demonstrations were held in more than 20 Italian cities as socioeconomic conditions in the country worsened by the day. 2 years of stringent restrictions to counter the COVID pandemic and the waves of sanctions against Russia that have followed Moscow's military operation in Ukraine are dragging Italy into its deepest recession since World War II. In Rome, thousands gathered in People's Square for a rally called by Italy's major trade union, CGL. The unionists called on the government to improve the country's employment situation, put an end to socioeconomic inequalities, and adopt measures to counter growing inflation and the ongoing energy crisis.
It is not acceptable that we are not consulted by the government when they introduce important provisions. A growing number of people cannot make ends meet and extraordinary measures are needed. We must have our say.
Also on Saturday, a string of left-leaning pro-sovereignty movements staged anti-government protests in 22 cities, including Rome, Genoa, Trieste and Cagliari. In the Italian capital, over 1,000 people protested against arms supplies to Ukraine and the adoption of sanctions against Russia, which they say are only damaging Italy and the Italians.
There is a major difference between what the Italians think about the Ukraine war and the way the economy should be run and what the government and the parliament do. Finally, on Tuesday, for the first time since the start of the war, Prime Minister Draghi will address the parliament. Draghi has so far done everything he wanted.
There has been talk of a possible government crisis after Mario Draghi addresses the Senate on June 21st. A growing number of lawmakers complained that no debate has so far been held on crucial issues, including how anti-Russia sanctions can affect Italy.
High inflation, rising costs of energy, high levels of unemployment, all Italy's socioeconomic indicators are headed downwards. In addition to that, the wealthy northern Italy has been hit by an unprecedented drought, which is severely threatening water supplies and the agri-food sector, as the country is struggling to cope with years of negligence and bad policies. A hot autumn of strikes and protests is widely expected. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of businesses across the European Union are struggling to stay open due to unprecedented costs relating to energy and supplies. We spoke to one cafe owner in Brussels.
How is it possible to survive in business? Electricity, oil, gas, and buying in stock is crazy. Prices are crazy. If we do not get more support, we will go under.
Inflation is through the roof. Poverty is on the rise. EU finance ministers have been told there needs to be a more coordinated response.
We continue to support our economies, but not in a universal way as we did during the COVID crisis, in a more targeted way.
Most EU